Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of January. This hour, Science in American Society. In the New York Times earlier this week, an essay from science writer Dennis Overby, who says that when Barack Obama proclaimed during his inaugural address that he would restore science to its rightful place, you could feel a dark cloud lifting like a sigh from the shoulders of the scientific community in this country. His first reaction was to worry that scientists were now in the awkward position of being expected to save the world. And as they say, he writes, be careful what you wish for. His second reaction was to wonder what the rightful place of science in our society really is. And that's the thrust of our conversation, the first hour of our program today. We'll be speaking with a senior scientist and director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who's particularly concerned about problems that we've seen over the last administration with interference at the Environmental Protection Agency and also some atmosphere of pressure in the government. Will that change under this new administration, and what would she like to see changed? Later in the hour, a professor in the Center for Theoretical Neuroscience and Department of Neuroscience at Columbia University Medical Center, and he was part of a letter that was published to the new president saying that as part of the economic stimulus package, these Nobel laureates and eminent scientists ask for the president to consider an immediate increase in funding for scientific research. So we'll be talking about all of that this hour of the program and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And I think that we have finally worked out some way to take your emails. So we have a little system we've worked out so you can send emails as well. We'll be checking them during the course of our hours today, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Joining us now, the first half hour of our program today is Professor Francesca Griffo, Senior Scientist, Director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she acts to mobilize scientists and citizens to defend the integrity of government science from political interference. She ran the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation Graduate Policy Workshop at Columbia University before this, and the Science Teachers Environmental Education Program, and was Director of the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation and a curator of the Hall of Biodiversity at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Professor Griffo, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Let's start with some of the problems that you would like to not see repeated in the new administration and start with your concern about interference that has taken place at the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, you know, there are a long list of ways in which we've seen, science abused. And I just want to start by being clear that, you know, this past administration didn't have the corner on that market. They certainly took it to extremes and to a depth and breadth that we had not previously seen, but certainly they didn't invent it. So I just want to make this not so much a partisan issue, because really it's a huge issue for the American people. And I think what we're talking about are, you know, falsifying data, fabricating results, selective editing, false uncertainty, tampering with scientific procedures. I mean, there's a very long list of things that have gone wrong. And I think one of the chief things, as you say, one of the agencies we've looked at, one of nine agencies we've examined closely, is the Environmental Protection Agency. And there, what we've seen are, you know, really just the Office of Management and Budget, which is a part of the White House, really overstepping its boundaries and being very involved in what the laws tell us should be science-based decisions made at the Environmental Protection Agency.
And why would there be, on the part of this past administration and other administrations, falsifying, tampering with scientific procedures? Why?
Well, I think what we've seen in this day and age is that science is, in fact, a very powerful tool in the policy arena. And so what we saw happening was, wow, if we want this policy end, let's change the science so that it gets us to that end. And that's a huge problem. There also are economic pressures. I mean, significant economic pressures pushing towards, you know, certain outcomes that may not be the best for the health and safety of the American people. The other thing that we've seen are, you know, ideological concerns, places where ideologies come into it. And that's mostly been in the area of reproductive health.
Mm-hmm. And so what this is all should be about, which is a search for what the truth is, right, which is a pretty important thing to do in this society. What is the truth when it comes to all of these issues that are of vital concern, actually, to the survival of this planet?
Well, you know, I'm not sure we always have the truth or know the truth, but that doesn't mean we don't want the best available science. Mm-hmm. We certainly want to know everything that we know. I mean, who wants to make a decision with only a part of the information or with information that's been, you know, besmirched or changed? That's not a good way to make a decision, no matter who you are.
What do you think the president meant, and maybe you've had a chance to talk with him about this, when he said in his inaugural he pledged to restore science to its rightful place? What does that mean?
I wish we'd had a chance to chat, but not so far.
You will maybe down the road. Huh?
Maybe down the road. In any case, what I think he meant, because we have obviously been, you know, talking to a lot of his advisors and working with the transition teams, is that he wants this abuse to stop. Now, obviously, you know, there's a big debate about what is the exact and rightful role of science in public policy. But I think what he's talking about is that when that science is moving from the agencies, from the scientific community, into the policy arena, you don't want to change it. You want it to get into that arena, you know, in the state that it was in. We don't want to, you know, manipulate those results or change the analysis or, you know, suppress it or censor it. You really want it to be a full and vigorous part of that policy debate. Not that science rules. You know, it's that's not how it will be, or, you know, unless the statute says that. And in some cases, we do have laws that say this decision shall be based on the best available science. But when the statute doesn't say that, when it is, in fact, a policy decision, you want good science to go into that policy decision.
Mm-hmm. Have you been impressed with the cabinet members who have been announced that will deal with science? Do you have concerns with the announcements at all?
You know, I have been really thrilled with the first steps that they've all taken. I mean, obviously, you know, Dr. Chu at the head of the Energy Department is just a star. I mean, a brilliant intellect, and I think is going to be just a fabulous Secretary of Energy. Obviously, you know, Jane Lubchenco, one of the early signers of our scientist statement that we put together 5 years ago that now has 15,000 scientists that have signed it. She was one of the early signers. She's going to be the head of NOAA. Dr. John Holdren, who's going to be the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, another early signer. But I think what's really telling is their first statements. And I think Lisa Jackson sent out an email to all the folks at the EPA, you know, on her first day in office, and it was a fabulous memo. It said, I'm going to run this agency as if it's open. I mean, I'm going to run this agency so that people know what's going on. She said, science must be the backbone for EPA programs. She said, I will pledge that I will not compromise the integrity of EPA's experts in order to advance a preference for a particular regulatory outcome. Those are brilliant, wonderful words. And now we have to all work with her and support her as she tries to implement that into the actual day-to-day workings of the agency.
Right. That's quite a memo, isn't it?
Oh, extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I really hope your listeners dig it out and read it, because it's the way government ought to be.
And where do we read it?
EPA's website.
Okay. Okay.
Yep, January 23rd memo to all EPA employees from Lisa Jackson.
Okay. I like your description, and one would hope that we're seeing this across the board in those agency heads and people who are running our government, that we have, just as we find in Dr. Chu, brilliant intellects. I like that phrase. That those are the people who should govern, brilliant intellects.
Intellects with a smidgen of pragmatism.
That sounds okay. You mentioned early when we were talking about the EPA that your organization has looked at 9 areas. What are some of the other areas?
The other agencies, well, the Food and Drug Administration, we've looked at a group of climate agencies. We've looked at, as I said, Environmental Protection Agency, Fish and Wildlife, some parts of NOAA. It's a, you know, a long list across the federal government.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to Food and Drug Administration, because that's very much on our mind with the latest salmonella here. Is this agency just not, this isn't a case where people are bending science, is it? It seems to me as though it's a case where there's not enough oversight, there's not enough money. What's going on with those agencies? They've made a lot of press the last few years.
Well, I think what's happened in a nutshell at the FDA is they've forgotten that the American people are their client. And they've really become an instrument of industry in so many ways. Now, does that mean that there aren't a lot of amazing, hardworking scientists at the FDA? No. We're talking about that level above them, the level above them that, unfortunately, we've decided that we're not going to put sufficient tax dollars into the Food and Drug Administration to allow it to do its job, and that instead we have a piece of legislation that says we're going to get that money to do those reviews from industry, and this is specifically drugs and devices. So when you've got industry supplying the money for the reviews, then obviously a supervisor who's controlling those reviews is really going to be, you know, under the influence of industry in a way that does not serve the American people.
Mm-hmm. And has it always been so, or is that a radical departure from the way we used to regulate?
That's how it's been for the last, I don't know the year, but about 8-10 years that since PDUFA passed, which is the Prescription Drug Act that set up this economic system. I mean, it was also set up because FDA was slow. I mean, admittedly, we weren't getting the drugs through at the speed, but there's nothing helpful about speed if we don't have safe and, you know, effective drugs coming out the other end and devices.
Right. Other concerns that you have, other areas that need attention?
Well, I think, you know, when we look at how do we clean up this mess, I mean, we're really looking at five things. I mean, we're looking at transparency across the board. And I think that's another one where we saw a very early executive order that sets this in motion, talks about the Freedom of Information Act. And I think what it says there is, which is very critical, no longer are we going to be in this position where everything is held back unless somebody demands to see it. Rather, we have a new attitude, which is, everything belongs to the American people. If your tax dollars and our government are putting this information together, then that information belongs to the citizens. And only in certain instances, when we're talking about national security or proprietary interests, you know, that will be the rare exception that we hold that back. And I think once we have that, you know, those rays of sunshine coming in on the way our government works, I think we'll find it's much, much harder to abuse the science.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one we've been looking at. Another is really protecting government scientists. We need, as a last resort, the ability for these scientists to speak up when they see something wrong. After all, their eyes and ears are in these agencies. They are the front lines. And if they observe waste, fraud, abuse of science, any of those things, they need to have very strong whistleblower protections. And we're hopeful right now because, in fact, an amendment was passed last night with the stimulus package in the House that actually provides that protection.
Oh, really?
So we're hoping the Senate will pick it up and do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things. Obviously, the regulatory system has, you know, a lot that needs to be done. You asked me before if there were appointees that I had concerns about. There is an appointee who would be going into the Office of Management and Budget as the head of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, a gentleman named Cass Sunstein. We're not quite sure how he's going to be. We're hopeful that all of the wild and crazy things he said as an academic were just that, kind of, you know, just being provocative as one is in academia, and that when he's in this position, he'll settle down and really think about what that means. The time will tell. So we have some regulatory issues that are ongoing.
We're going to welcome phone calls and emails for our guest right now. Our guest is Professor Francesca Griffo, Senior Scientist and Director of the Scientific Inquiry Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I guess the question of this hour, which might seem rather lofty, but I'm sure you can take it in whatever direction you like, is what it means to restore science to its rightful place, which is what President Obama said during his inaugural address. And we're looking at a number of different agencies and concerns that Francesca has in her position in terms of restoring science to its rightful place, in terms of transparency, in terms of what she said, protecting government scientists and the regulatory system, which we're seeing is falling apart a bit when it comes to protecting our food in this country. What do you think needs to happen to restore science to its rightful place? What are you worried about that has happened in the past, and not just the past 8 years, but in the past? And what are you hopeful for concerning science as we move ahead? Here's our number. Join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we will check your emails as well. We've figured out a way I think we can do that. So that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. org. Lines are open for you at this very moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, the managing editor of the Long War Journal, who is been reporting an analysis of the war on terror in a number of different places in the world, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Lebanon, and more extensively in Iraq, looking at al-Qaeda's operations, tactics, and strategy. So we'll be talking about that with him, our number two of our program. Here's how you join us now, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls with Richard from Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi.
You had asked the question about restoring science to its rightful position and what that means. I'm a science teacher, so I may have a slightly biased answer, but it seems to me that I, in my last 12 years as a science teacher, I've watched sort of science be looked at as almost a belief system, as opposed to what it really is, which is a technique that has given us all of the fruits of modernity. And what I would like to see is a recognition of that. I think that really restoring it to its position.
Professor Griffo?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that, you know, the United States has enjoyed prosperity and health in a very large part because of its strong and sustained commitment to independent science. And I think, you know, as we face these new challenges at home and growing competitiveness and other issues abroad, certainly the need for a robust federal scientific enterprise becomes, you know, more and more critical. I think the perspective of science teachers is critical. I think that, you know, we really need to press this new administration to do more with, you know, science education so that we raise a generation of critical thinkers, because obviously that is the other, you know, very important defense from things like this happening again, these abuses, is to have, you know, critical thinking skills in our citizenry so that they just say, wait a minute, that just doesn't sound right. That's a huge check and balance on you know, abuses of science.
Yeah. And what do you teach, Richard?
I teach a program really focused on nature, a broader look at that, including physics. And I would also just kind of put in a plug for basic physics research, which is probably the most expensive, hardest to get funded, least knowable in terms of what the outcomes are going to be. But if you look historically, it produces the greatest discoveries and the most important discoveries.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks so much for the call. I keep thinking, I've always thought this, and I know we have you know, a lot of advertising agencies, et cetera, in this country, but it seems to me as though when we do science shows, I'm just in awe of what people know and what they're working on, Professor Griffo. And I wish that somehow the science community could be more front and center, could let us know exactly what they're doing, because it's totally remarkable.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, one of the things that I look at is I have, you know, middle school boys, and I think, what are they doing with these computer games, and why can't we figure out a way to have these amazing discoveries be a part of that sort of everyday existence?
Right.
I mean, I think there are, you know, National Public Radio, PBS, a lot of places are doing a lot of really good work on that, but I'm also very worried about the removal of, you know, many of our very important science reporters. I mean, it's a rare thing now to find a newspaper that has someone whose beat is science. Mm-hmm. And this is a, you know, very important role, translating role, to take that information out of the journals, out of the discovery realm, and into what we read every day in our newspapers. So right. There are big problems, you know, CNN cutting its science reporters and so on. So I hope that this is something that, again, we'll see this administration turn more attention toward.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that came from Carl from rural La Crosse. Many science decisions are rendered by quasi-judicial boards or panels within regulatory agencies. The people come from the industries they regulate in a revolving door environment. Often the people on these boards may have scientific backgrounds, but mostly have performed as administrators. Will we have a new kind of science court for decisions?
Yeah, I think what your writer is referring to are, you know, advisory committees and stakeholder committees. And I think that's a really important distinction. Right now, we have lots of different ways that agencies get science advice and have, you know, their regulatory results looked at. And I think one of the problems in the past has been exactly what he said, is that there is this revolving door that people are from industry. And we are working very hard to push this administration to adopt a no conflicts of interest policy. I mean, there is no reason why someone who is taking money from industry to do research in a field should also be influencing the way that research is used in an agency. It's a conflict of interest. It makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for them to represent the interests of the American people. I mean, they are not there to represent their special interests. They are there, you know, really to represent the interests of all Americans. So we're looking at, which doesn't mean that that information isn't important. It means they come to a meeting, they present their information, and they don't vote. They don't influence the discussion. They just give that information to the other panel members, and they then make an, you know, as unbiased a decision, as unconflicted a decision as they can. So he's right. That system has a lot of problems. The Federal Advisory Committee Act, it's called FACA, is certainly on our list of things to look at, you know, really further reforming.
Thanks, Richard, for your call. Jim from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. How you doing, Kevin?
All right, Jim. How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
Thanks for asking. My question is somewhat similar to the last question you had for the email, but it relates to the judicial branch and where we go from here. In recent years, courts have come into the game here, particularly in what something that's of personal interest to me is impacting the breadth and scope of the Clean Water Act and laws like that and how they're applied and enforced. And I wonder, I asked the guests, and I take my answer off the air, but I asked them what extent the Obama administration would have through administrative policy and these agencies to reverse some of that, or is that all going to require legislative action, which to my mind is a more tedious and longer process?
Yeah, I take your point completely. I mean, I think we do have a huge issue in the judicial branch. For a long time, you know, early on, if we go back to Storm King and, you know, the early, you know, environmental litigation, you know, it took so much for anybody to get standing on these issues. And certainly we've come a long way from there, but I'm not sure it hasn't been without its pitfalls. And I think, you know, the expert witness and so on are really very difficult for judges to sort out a lot of that information. A couple of things that I think, you know, we can do, and I think you're right, most of it is going to have to wait for legislative changes in the laws of evidence and that kind of thing. But I think some of it might happen through executive orders. And certainly, you know, we can look at and hold the Obama administration's feet to the fire on their judicial appointees and really making this a part of what those appointees are asked about in their confirmation hearings and in the process of their being appointed. But I agree, it's a big problem, and it certainly needs our attention.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Jane from Waukesha. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm joining the program a little bit late, so I hope that I'm not entirely off topic. But my comment is that I've been disappointed in how our government scientists or government scientist agencies like the FDA, I feel that there's a lot of industry and money influencing the decisions and some of the statements that they're making. My example would be the bisphenol A. You know, if you talk to people from other countries, that's been in the forefront of the news. They've known about it, known that it was a problem for a while. And, you know, then it came here, and the FDA said, oh, yeah, you know, we're looking into it, but we don't think that it's a problem. And I just feel that had to be influenced by industry and money.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we did talk a little bit about FDA and why it is FDA is like that, but certainly, you know, when we have a new commissioner appointed to the FDA, we will look, you know, when that person is confirmed and use those confirmation hearings, excuse me, as a way of really asking them about, you know, the rightful role of industry and how do we control the influence of industry on that agency. One of the other things that we're looking at, and we did have passed in a piece of legislation, but it hasn't quite been implemented, is this notion of when the FDA looks over information that comes in from industry and decides about whether or not something is safe, that they would have to put out a statement very quickly and very concisely that would tell us what the scientific basis of that decision is. And to, furthermore, anybody within the agency, so you have an agency scientist that disagrees, that those dissenters' views would also be a part of that package that would be available online. So that consumers, even if we don't agree with the decision that the FDA ends up making and we're not sure it's safe, we can look at that dissenter's opinion and really make an informed decision for what we want in our homes and, you know, want our families to be exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Professor Griffith, are the schools open in Washington today?
2-hour delay.
2-hour delay? You got more snow?
Ice.
Oh, you have ice again today?
Ice again today, yes. Well, you know, we're not very good at it.
I know. What did you think of the president's comments yesterday? You're just not as tough as people in Chicago.
Yeah, I think he hit it right on the head. I mean, I'm from New England, and man, it's like bumper cars down here when we get a little ice.
Is it? Yeah, you all need driving lessons, I guess. Maybe the government can give them to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. And can I just say, for people who want more information?
Yes, please.
Our website is www.ucsusa.org/federal science. And you can find just a huge amount more information on this topic there.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Our guest the first half hour is Professor Francesca Griffo, Senior Scientist, Director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're talking this hour about what it means to restore science to its rightful place. When hasn't it been in its rightful place, and what kind of restoration do we need? That was found in President Obama's inaugural address, so we have two guests this hour addressing it. And we turn now to Professor Kenneth Miller, professor in the Center for Theoretical Neuroscience and Department of Neuroscience at Columbia University. His lab's interests focus on understanding the cerebral cortex, and they use theoretical and computational methods to unravel the circuitry of the cerebral cortex. Isn't it amazing how people can do this in their lives? And in great admiration. There was a letter to the president signed by our guest this half hour and 49 American Nobel laureates, other distinguished American scientists, calling the president's attention to the importance of increased federal funding for scientific research. They start the letter saying, as part of your economic stimulus package, we ask you to consider an immediate increase in funding for scientific research. We deeply appreciate your commitment to increasing the funding that American science so desperately needs. And we're going to be talking about how increased funding for science may be, as these Nobel laureates and distinguished scientists say, funding will be an ideal economic stimulus in this country. And we're continuing to welcome your phone calls. Jane, thanks for your call. Our lines are open for Professor Miller, and that number is 800-486-8655. We are also monitoring emails this morning, so you will be able to get through by sending us an email at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Miller, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, this was a very, very interesting letter. Can you tell me about the origins of it, how these American Nobel laureates, distinguished scientists, got together and decided to publish a letter to the president?
Sure. The truth is, it started, I'm a scientist, and I'll tell you about the situation of the NIH funding right now, which is
sure.
really very bad. And so we're all very worried and very frustrated. And so I was reading about the stimulus package and all the proposals to, you know, invest in roads and highways and infrastructure, which are all good proposals, but I didn't hear a word about science. And my feeling was, you know, the amounts involved for science are so tiny compared to the stimulus package, and it's so important. Why don't we need to have science as part of the stimulus package. And so I had this idea. Now, it turns out I'm one floor above Eric Kandel, who's a very well-known neuroscientist, Nobel Prize winner. And I ran into Eric in the hall, and I proposed this idea to him. And he said, great idea, write something up. And I did. And then, to make a long story short, he put me in touch with various other heavyweights and Nobel Prize winners, and went through various iterations and converged upon this letter. And then we sent it out under Eric's name and to a whole set of Nobel Prize winners that we had put together, and almost everyone very readily signed because they recognize this, as we all do, the really dangerous situation science is in right now.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about in this letter that each $1 billion of NIH research grant funding can create over 15,000 jobs with an average wage of $52,000 a year. That's significant, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I guess that's about $60,000, $70,000 per job, whereas in the most of the stimulus package funding they're talking about $150,000 per job. So I'm not an economist. I'm not quite sure why the discrepancy, but it seems to be the science, you get a lot of bang for your buck.
Right.
It also turns out that the multiplier on science funding has been estimated to be about $2.20, meaning for every dollar the government invests in science, the overall economic activity, you get $2.20 worth, because they put a dollar in science, and the scientists buy some supplies from a business firm, and the business firm buys some supplies from somebody else, and so forth. So.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned early on that the funding was very bad, the NIH particularly. What's the problem?
Not enough money. Science is growing, and the NIH funding has been shrinking. There was a doubling of the NIH budget achieved over some number of years. I don't remember. I would guess either 6 years or 10 years. And that was finished around 2004. Since then, the budget of the NIH has been flat in nominal, you know, in number of dollars. But if you take into account inflation, the budget has fallen by about 14% since 2004.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. At the same time, the, science as an enterprise is only growing. And so the competition has just become extremely difficult, where I can give you some numbers. I mean, when you put in a grant to, and I want to say in advance, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm whining. There's a lot of Americans that are in a lot worse shape than scientists are. As individuals, we're not in such bad shape. You know, a lot of us have tenured professors. The ones who aren't tenured are in worse shape, because if they can't get grants, they can't get tenure, and they're going to lose their jobs, and that's something people are very worried about. But we're not suffering like a lot of the American people are personally,
mm-hmm.
But science is suffering, and the ability to do science is suffering, and I think that's important to America as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So with that said, just to tell you how it works, if I put in a grant, so typically, the letter talks about all across science, not just the NIH. The NIH funds biomedical science, the National Institutes of Health. But I do neuroscience research, so what I know about is the NIH, so that's what I'll tell you about.
Sure.
And when I put in a grant for the NIH, they typically fund a grant for about average of 4 years, up to 5 years. It goes into a study section, other scientists who review it. Well, only 10% of the grants in that study section get funded. That number was 25-30% not too many years ago, and that's really a healthy level. At 10%, several things happen. First of all, it becomes almost a matter of chance. The fact is that the discrimination isn't that good. You can probably tell there's a lot of very good grants, in other words, that just don't get funded. The second thing that happens is if you don't get funded on the first round, then you get to resubmit, which takes, it's an 8-month cycle. So basically, you know, every time you don't get funded, you lose 8 months, and you only get 3 chances. So your first, second, third. You get to resubmit. And what happens very quickly is that now many of the grants that the study section is looking at are revisions on their second try or their third try. And they know that if these people don't get it on their third try, then they're out. And on the second try, already they. And so what happens is that on your first try, at this point, you have almost no chance of getting funded. Hmm. It's basically just like a queue, a line. You have to put in the first time so you don't get it, so you can put in the second time so that then you might have a chance of getting it. And so the system is just basically broken. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to get your grants, to get a grant, which is what lets you do research, because basic research does not have an immediate product in mind, is not going to lead to somebody making money tomorrow off what we learn.
Right.
And so the only thing that can fund that is the federal government. No mm-hmm. business is going to invest in that. And so that's why we need funding from the federal government.
Yeah.
So the situation now is that new investigators are really threatened, because if they can't show that they can get funding, it's very hard for them to get tenure. And established investigators are in great difficulty. Labs are being shut down, or they're running, you know, at much lower level than they want to. So there needs to be a substantial boost in science funding, and this has been true all across the board in the physical sciences and in all across science. The funding has been very low. The one thing I do know about the other sciences, for the physical sciences, there had been a plan to double spending over 10 years, and there was a law passed, the America Competes Act, in 2007, that was supposed to begin this doubling, and it's never begun, and instead funding has fallen in real terms for in real dollars for physical sciences as well.
And give me more of a sense for those people who want to know how science is affecting them directly or could make their lives a whole lot better. In what way is science growing and funding is not just keeping up with it?
I don't have the numbers here as to, you know, science growing. What I can say is
just the areas that are exploding in knowledge.
Well, everywhere. The growth of in biomedical research, the growth of the human genome project, knowledge of the human genome, and the multiple tools that are exploding and opening up for studying the expressions of genes, the expressions of proteins across all different kinds of tissues are just they're revolutionizing our understanding of cells and of physiology. And then what I work in, neuroscience, is another field that is really it's the amount of knowledge is increasing just so rapidly it's very hard to keep up with. Now, at the same time, I have to say it's an exciting field to be in because we don't understand the basics. I mean, if you ask somebody how does the kidney work, you know, they can tell you more or less. There's still lots of research questions, but we know. You ask somebody how the brain works, well, I can tell you how lots of little pieces of it work, but I can't tell you how the brain works. Mm-hmm. We don't know the basics. So it's still a very young field, and the tools with which we can just observe what's going on in the brain are growing enormously and rapidly. And so it's a field that we're just learning a tremendous amount about every year, and this knowledge ultimately is leading toward the ability to treat brain damage, the ability to treat neurological disorders, the ability to treat mental illness, because that, of course, is in the brain, and more fundamentally, just to understand our own minds, who we are, what it is that makes us us.
Right.
And also, as I like to say, that if you want to be you can't treat a broken kidney unless you know how a kidney works. Well, the brain is a big part of who we are, and there's lots of ways it can be not working right. But if we don't know how it's supposed to work, we're in bad shape to really do very much about it. So really the basic insight into how it works is going to underlie treatment of any neurological or mental disease.
We're going to go to phone calls. Dr. Kenneth Miller is our guest. He's at the Center for Theoretical Neuroscience in the Department of Neuroscience at Columbia University Medical School. Our attention drawn in subsequent show from a letter to the editor that was posted on January 26. 49 American Nobel laureates, distinguished scientists, and it was the idea of our guest this hour to publish this letter to President Obama about scientific research and funding for scientific research. Our number, our lines are all crowded right now, but eventually I hope you get an opening. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more of your phone calls and emails now, 800-486-8655, and let's go to Chris from Glendale. Hi, Chris.
I have two observations. When I talk to middle-class non-scientists, I sometimes hear two things. The first is I notice that some people seem proud that they do not understand basic physics. They seem proud that they don't understand how basic physics relates to everyday decision-making. Second thing I notice is I hear a lot of people saying, quote, science is a belief system, end quote. Is that statement true or false?
little tiny bit of truth in it, but I don't. I would say fundamentally, I think it's false. You can't. There's no such thing as purely objective without any subjectivity in it. We can't talk about the world without using words and categories that come from our minds. And so there's no such thing as a purely objective description. But what science does is it's a process of continually testing our conceptions. You think it works this way? Let's formulate clearly what that means. Let's see what the predictions would be. Let's test those predictions. And you know, it's a process of systematically breaking what we think we know, and forcing us to come up with better and better conceptualizations of it. And so, in the end, we arrive at a conceptual system, which, although you know, it's never free of the subjective, it's never free of our own minds formulating the ideas. It's been very solidly tested and pushed and shoved and forced to cope with all kinds of data that, you know, weren't initially imagined. And when you're done, you've got a very powerful system, one that, you know, is really, really works across a very, very broad range of phenomena. And you're constantly trying to test it against the range of phenomena that hasn't been tested against in order to, you know, discover what's wrong with it, what's missing from it, what new ingredients have to go into it to extend it into new realms. But it's a very powerful process that has been launched in Western thought, I guess, that has led to the sciences.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Jim from Nisita, hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jim.
Yeah, my comments on this, putting research funding and economic stimulus packages beyond pork, that's lard. I worked as an ag researcher. We were funded through private foundation through Kellogg's, and it was an education grant, and anything that they would be researching is going to be 10 years down the road at minimum. It's not going to do something tomorrow, the next day, which is what we need. And what they need to do with the economic stimulus package, yes, I'm all for the road building, the infrastructure, but they need to be funding small business more than they are. Small business can't get loans anywhere right now. And that's where the jobs are created.
So you would...
Big business doesn't create the jobs. Big business cuts jobs when they get bigger. They automate.
Well, so let me just speak to that. What I'm not going to disagree with you about small business versus big business. What we're talking about is the funding of science research, primarily, which is basically done in universities and in research institutions, not in big business or in small business. But our main point in writing the letter was that, in fact, this is an extremely effective way of making jobs. That money invested in science, it's true that the results of scientific research take a long time to lead to businesses that make use of them. But the immediate spending on scientific research is better than road building, as far as I can tell, in terms of making jobs. And that was one of our main points, that to put together the two ideas, that science funding right now is really in pretty desperate straits, and science is really suffering. There's a real need, which President Obama has spoken to restore science funding to where it needs to be for science to be healthy. What we were arguing is that the stimulus... Some people might say because we're in such a difficult financial situation right now that priorities like restoring the funding of science would have to wait. And we're arguing to the contrary. When you fund science, you are stimulating the economy. You're creating jobs. Every dollar invested in science makes $2.20, or at least in NIH funding, makes $2.20 of business activity. A dollar, most of the stimulus package, they're talking about a dollar making $1.50 of business activity. It makes every $1 billion makes 15,000 jobs. Most of the stimulus package they're talking about, I don't know, but I think about half that. So, because not only does it fund the scientists and the people who work in the labs, but then the scientists buy equipment and software from small businesses that specialize in supplying science. We generally don't buy much from big businesses because we have very special needs. And it goes on and on through the economy, and it creates jobs. And so what we wanted to say was, do that investment that science needs right now because it's going to stimulate the economy.
So where do you stand in terms of the stimulus package and what passed the House and where it's going with the Senate? Are people in Congress responding to your request?
Well, yes and no. The excuse me, the non-NIH science did very well in the House Appropriations Committee, somewhat less well in the Senate Appropriations, and so that'll be decided in Conference Committee. Basically, the non-NIH science funding, the amount in the stimulus package was about 50 to 70% of the 2008 budgets for these agencies for outside of NIH, and so that was really as much as people could have hoped for. The NIH is the big one, so all the other ones together don't add up to half of NIH. Mm-hmm. And NIH had a much smaller increase. It was, I think, 10% of its 2008 budget within the stimulus package, and most of that was specifically for construction.
Mm.
And what happened, I believe, and I'm not an insider on this. I have a little bit of touch with some insiders, but I really don't know all the details. But there's a problem with funding science as part of a stimulus package, and that is when you fund scientific research, it needs to be a long-term commitment. For example, if you fund 1,000 new grants at NIH this year, well, those grants have an average lifetime of 4 years. That means that you've put in this year's budget for those 1,000 grants, but that means you've committed yourself for the next 3 years to find the funding for those 1,000 grants in your budget for those years as well. So if the stimulus package gives us, you know, 1 or 2 years of funding and then goes away, then all of a sudden you've got this commitment to fund more grants than you had previously. It means that the number of new grants you can fund that year will actually go down, not up. So you're going to make things worse in terms of scientific funding. So, therefore, if you put research funding in a stimulus package, it's got to be paired with a commitment to keep it up long term. And our analysis of that was essentially, if you start right now, it's going to make a great stimulus. And this is something you want to do long term. This is one of President Obama's stated priorities. And once we no longer, as long as we need a stimulus, the science spending provides a great stimulus. When we don't need a stimulus anymore, then the economy should be in shape to do this because it needs doing. And the amounts of money we're talking about are very small. The entire NIH budget is $30 billion right now. I mean, at most, we might talk about increasing that by, even if we doubled that, we'd be talking about another $30 billion. Compare that to the $850 billion stimulus budget. So we're talking about very small amounts of money for science, but they make a huge difference to how science gets done. Unfortunately, what seems to have happened is that for the NIH advocates, the fear of becoming overcommitted now to new research grants and then having to cut new research grants in the future if the funding goes away, so the fear of a bubble of funding was so great that they just didn't ask for research funding, whereas in the non-NIH science agencies, they seem to have gone for it and just hoped that it would be sustained in the future.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. We go to Mike from Milwaukee. Hey, Mike.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yeah, very interesting show. I think that Craig Venter was the one that really pushed the government into racing with him to crack the genome. And, of course, he had the idea what to do. They didn't. And he got funding on his own. He never took 2 cents worth of government help. What about Crick and Watson, who did the structure of DNA, did most of their best work at the Eagle Pub? What about Albert Einstein, who did most of his best work at a restaurant? What about the fact is that Senator Proxmire had an award for science that was sort of, I don't know, maybe not worth the money we were paying from our tax money? Who's going to be the watchdog for this? This is like a bunch of piranha fish.
Okay, let's get a response. Running short on time. Dr. Miller.
Yeah, I can't speak to Venter. I don't know much about what happened there, except to say that when you've got one big idea, it might be possible, as he did, I guess, to raise private funds for it. And I honestly don't know how much of what he did was private funds and how much was public funds. But you can't run scientific research on private funds because the money just isn't there. And believe me, scientists try to raise private funds because we're desperately in need of money right now. Watson and Crick were being paid by an English lab, which was part of the government. I think pretty much all the English universities are supported by the government.
Albert Einstein is this wonderful case where, you know, a guy worked in a patent office and he did science in his spare time and changed the world.
Right.
But you can't do very much science like that. I mean, Albert Einstein is not typical. And the scale of science today, and particularly, you know, what he did, you could do with a pencil and paper. And there's still some science you can do with a pencil and paper, but an awful lot of science takes a lot of equipment, and a lot of equipment takes a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make progress as a society in science by funding science off charity and off patent officers working in their spare time. One individual here and there might be able to do it, but those are very rare exceptions.
Dr. Miller, thank you so much for being with us. It was a really good hour. Thank you. Dr. Kenneth Miller is professor in the Center for Theoretical Neuroscience and the Department of Neuroscience at Columbia University Medical School. The letter to the president posted on January 26, a letter to Obama signed by 49 American Nobel laureates. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, and thanks to John Treader and Sherry Esser for on-air production, and we'll return following the news on the Ideas Network.